Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is August 31st, 2017. I'm Noah Rothman. With me, as always, is our senior editor, Abe Greenwald.
Hi, Noah.
John is out at an undisclosed location in a domestic sort of facility with his family, enjoying himself, and we will leave it at that. He will be back next week.
Actually, domestic facility sounds suddenly very suspicious. I mean,
that's true. Minimum security. Yeah. Don't worry about him. He's doing just fine. Come and join us on commentarymagazine.com, where we give you a few free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe. $19.95 gives you a digital subscription. $29.95 gives you an all-access subscription and our beautiful monthly print magazine in your mailbox. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where you can read me, as well as many other luminaries in the field of cultural and political analysis. It's worth your time. We're going to begin today with a little story that is not being covered to the extent that it should be, which is the forthcoming corruption trial of New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez. We're not going to talk too much about it because there's not a lot to talk about, but this week the prosecutors put forward their allegations against the senator, and they are eye-popping. They're pretty significant, and they include, most significantly for me, the assertion that former Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid intervened, when he was Majority Leader actually, intervened on behalf of Bob Menendez at his request to get the Obama administration to weigh in on the investigation into him and possibly even to lean on the Justice Department. We don't know, but these are very serious allegations. And it's the sort of thing that somebody should be paying attention to.
Yeah, but although no one is there's nothing resembling charges coming against Reid.
No, not yet. If ever, I mean, it's not. I don't know whether or not these are even prosecutable allegations, but there's certainly allegations of corruption of a kind that you would think would resonate even in conservative media. I mean, we're seeing in conservative media sort of this just beginning to resonate, but. It's not as though this is new. I mean, we've known that this trial was coming along. These allegations are new, but we've known this trial was going to be something worth paying attention to for some time, and we're still talking about Hillary's server.
Right. Well, there's the doctor's name, Bob Menendez's friend. What is it?
Magellan?
Not quite. It's close. I don't think it's quite that.
Magellan? Something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
It looks like Magellan.
Yeah, I mean, regardless of the outcome, just the lengthy description of the free private plane, private jet flights that apparently both Reid and Menendez took, and the vacation spots, and you know, it's all just sleazy,
very
stuff.
Sordid. But you know what frustrates me, I think, is that the right has a tendency to lean into this phenomena, and it happens quite often. Where there was this allegation, I don't know if you remember, around 2013, there was this allegation that it involved child sex scandals, like that had something to do with this, and it feels like child sex scandals bubble up from the fringes of right, conspiracy theorying. That's what got the deranged individual to shoot up Comet Pizza in Washington D.C. The allegation there was some sort of a child sex ring operated by Democrats in the basement. There's a variety of other allegations that just have to do with this really sordid behavior, and it's so bizarre because it gives Democrats the opportunity to say, well, you're just crazy, when what is being alleged here is certainly not crazy. It's just sort of boilerplate corruption of the kind that should cost you your job.
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, it's true that I think when you start talking about this rumors of the child sex scandals and whatnot, it's this stuff brings up sort of our worst, darkest fears and fantasies about the nature of politicians in general, and sort of we go to the worst place with it. And I always wonder when these things come up, how many other senators and people similarly positioned are sort of quaking in their boots and saying, "Oh, okay, you know, I hope they don't find out about my free flights, my vacations, my little call helping out so and so." You know,
Maybe that has a lot to do with why you haven't heard a whole bunch. I mean, there's obviously sort of the demands of just a collegial atmosphere in the upper chamber and even politics in general, where you know, there should be a presumption of innocence, obviously, and the senator is presumed innocent.
We should probably just explain in the broadest sense what the story is about. I mean, he's accused of having done political favors for a long-time friend of his who's a doctor, who was accused of bilking, Medicare for his services, or overcharging the government for his services. And then so Menendez is alleged of trying to pull strings to help him, and then trying to lean on Harry Reid to do the same. Apparently, there's reports that Reid spoke to a White House staffer about this, and the staffer declined to do anything about it, and that's sort of the state of the case. That plus a lot of details, sort of lurid details about vacations and private jets and whatnot.
Right. So this is a story that you should be paying attention to, because very few people are. And when it does explode, you're going to be on the cutting edge of this, because you were aware of it when everybody else was still talking about Hillary Clinton's server or Russia or what have you. Moving on, though, to the real focus of today's podcast, isn't Democrats behaving badly, but really Democratic voters behaving badly. We're going to go full tribal today. The arc of today's podcast begins with a talk that California Senator Dianne Feinstein was giving to constituents, and she was discussing the nature of the Trump presidency and how she was coming to terms, essentially, with the Trump presidency. And she said, look, the guy's probably going to serve out his full term, so we're going to have to come to terms with that fact, and I really do hope he learns on the job. And the audience went up like a tar baller. Boo! Furious with the notion that, A, Dianne Feinstein wasn't giving countenance to the idea that there would be some deliverance from the Trump era prematurely, and B, that she hoped that he performed better on the job, as though that's something we should reject. It struck me as sort of the Democratic Party's problem in a microcosm, because Democratic voters want to be delivered from the Trump era and are eager for somebody to feed that fantasy, which is, you know, who knows? Perhaps he could resign, but the notion of impeachment seems fanciful, and any other means of getting him out of office early are just not available. So it's just reality that Dianne Feinstein was saying, and the audience didn't want to hear reality. That seems like a big problem for Democrats.
Yeah, I think there's this long-standing, ever-exacerbating rupture between, like, the establishment left and – or the establishment Democrats and the activist left. And that gulf grows and grows and grows, and then obviously produced the split between the sort of Bernie and Hillary camps. And now we see it in this. If the incentives for a politician who is looking out for her career and perhaps hoping to get things done are far different than the incentives of these fire-breathing activists who absolutely cannot face what they say over and over again is, quote, normalizing Trump. And right. What Feinstein really said was a kind of version of normalization. Look, he's going to be there. Maybe he can learn. If he learns, he maybe even could be good. And that was a bridge too far. And by the way, in her clarifying remarks, she didn't really walk it back. She sort of further said, "Look, I don't expect that he'll learn or get better, but I have to hope he does."
There's nothing to walk back. What that audience wanted to hear is this guy is a racist anathema who doesn't belong in the Oval Office, and we will do everything within our power and maybe some things outside of our power to eject him from that office.
They wanted to hear her say, "He's not my president."
He's not there precisely. Right, that's right. Exactly what they want to hear. And honestly, there are way too many people on the left who are feeding into that impulse to the point where we move on to our next little tidbit in our journey through Democratic ridiculousness is Nancy Pelosi, who also did something responsible this week. And she didn't do it out of altruism, I can tell you that much. Nancy Pelosi issued a statement the other day, which was an unequivocal condemnation of Antifa, the organization that we talked about the other day, podcast number one on Monday, that executed some sort of a riot-type event where, in the name of no hate, they organized a paramilitary siege of Berkeley, California, to counter-demonstrate against some Trump supporters, not white nationalists, not neo-Nazis, Trump supporters, who, by the way, wanted to provoke a reaction, and boy, did they get one. And these Antifa demonstrators were violent, and they vandalized property, and they attacked people, and they put somebody in the hospital. And Nancy Pelosi came out and criticized these people very forcefully and said, violence has no place in the United States. Now, I don't really think she was doing that entirely out of a desire to be, you know, decent and express civic propriety, although she probably did do that. In some ways, it was pretty much elementary political competence, because while a lot has been said about the racially charged right, a whole lot has not been said about the reciprocal violence that we've seen on the left. And as much as it doesn't have any real fealty to the Democratic Party, it's a leftist movement, it's a liberal movement, and people are going to start to notice that this leftist movement, which is drawing energy from being anti-Trump, has a political home. And frankly, those of us who've been paying attention to this sort of thing know that there's a subculture on the left that has been indulging in violence, indulging in the prospect of political violence, and legitimizing the prospect of political violence in a way that it has no parallel on the right in places that are pretty respectable liberal outlets. The Nation magazine, Mother Jones magazine, The New Republic. And I can go into detail about those in a little bit.
Yeah, this is another perfect example of the establishment activist split on the left. And, you know, I had been seeing in social media sort of left people on the left treating Antifa and charges against Antifa and complaints about Antifa really as if it were fake news. I mean, sort of saying that I've heard everything from there are probably Russian-backed, you know, sort of
provocateurs.
Exactly.
Right?
Like, yeah.
A false flag.
Right. Right. Yeah. They're treating it like a false flag. And here, no, you have Nancy Pelosi saying, look, we've got to bring a semblance of reality to bear on what's going on here, and that's precisely what the activist base doesn't do.
Yeah, I see the same thing in social media when the right says, you know, look, there's violence on all sides is bad, and there really is actually a moral equivalency to violent people on the right and violent people on the left who are radical extremists, because one side is racist and the other ostensibly isn't. The left doesn't see the moral equivalency there. In fact, the violence is, if not entirely justified, at least understandable, maybe even a little valorous.
In their reading, yes.
And this has been going on for a long time. You know, you've heard me talk about ad nauseum the event in Sacramento a year ago, which, you know, you should read up on if you haven't been. It was a really horrifying moment, and definitely the precursor to what happened in Charlottesville, which we should have talked about at the time, and we didn't, and we're reaping the rewards of that. But since Donald Trump came to office, there has been a real subculture on the left that sort of looks to violence as an appropriate way to deal with these sort of conditions. On the 19th of January, The Nation's Natasha Leonard, who is sort of a paramilitary herself, scoffed at the notions that, quote, liberals cling to institutions, unquote, meanwhile, quote, it is the radical left, so often tarred as irrational, who are calling upon both the U.S. and European histories of anti-fascist actions to offer practical and serious responses in this political moment. And she then takes us on a history lesson through the Bolshevist movements of the 20th century and their righteousness and all the blood they spilled. We went through on Inauguration Day, when there was a ton of violence and a ton of vandalism, and the white supremacist activist Richard Spencer was sucker punched in the face on video. We had New York Times profiles, I mean, in the news section, asking, is it okay to punch a Nazi? As though this is like a really weighty philosophical question that required, you know, real, you know, existential thought. When there was the Women's March, for example, the New Republic's Jess Zimmerman complained about the Women's March because it was not transgressive enough and that there weren't enough people being beat up. And she thought that that was because there were too many white women, is that white women are protected by the police.
The Women's March is also where I believe Madonna got up and said she seriously thought about bombing the White House. Was that?
I think that was, yeah.
Yeah. So there's a strain of it all through the sort of left protest culture, from the sort of celebrity activist statements down to grassroots organizations. There's this idea.
By any means necessary. It's actually called By Any Means Necessary. And one of the, in a glowing profile of this, among other violent, ostensibly violent groups, and a profile on Mother Jones in May titled, "A New Wave of Left-Wing Militants is Ready to Rumble in Portland and Beyond." Portland was a response to a right-wing lunatic who was attacking verbally some Muslim women, and somebody intervened, and this right-wing lunatic stabbed some people. That provoked a reciprocal response that was wildly disproportionate from the militant left. The militant left was being celebrated. And among those organizations was By Any Means Necessary, which was the group that started this Sacramento riot, led by a woman named Yvette Falarca, who was recently charged with incitement to violence for her role in that event. And one of the organization's organizers, a civil rights attorney by the name of Shanta Driver, said, quote, "When we say by any means necessary, we mean everything from doing legal cases to organizing more militant actions." This is like 1968 stuff. Now, nobody's saying right now that there is no violence on the right, or there is no violent sentiment on the right. This white nationalist thing didn't come from nowhere. But we read right-wing magazines and left-wing magazines, and I haven't seen anything remotely like this in popular right-wing culture. I'm struggling to think of something that was even remotely similar that could be interpreted.
Well, the only thing, I just want to jump back one step and then I'll get to the point. There's also, you know, this was actually all in play when the Occupy movement rose up, too. There were Occupy offshoots that actually were throwing pipe bombs, and I forget, there was a group of five.
A group of five guys who were stung by the FBI who were trying to investigate how to buy explosives to blow up a bridge in Ohio.
Exactly right. And there was also a sort of like a seizure of like a port in Oakland, right, at an Occupy event. And similarly, there was not only the violence, but there was the denial among Occupy fellow travelers at the time. Oh, that's not the same as what Occupy just wants fairness. They're peacefully occupying. They're not. You know, and yet it was all there. It was all. Readily available for anyone to see. The only thing that I can even remotely think of on the right in respectable right circles is this. Often you hear talk about a coming civil war, but that's a sort of abstract sort of analysis. We know, and that requires all sorts of further specifications about what they mean by that, and it's more, you know, it's not a plan except on the crazy fringe extremes that are, you know, being investigated and whatnot.
Well, I think that's a really good point. And when you see that sort of talk, which by the way we call out whenever we see it, and it's a good thing to do right now. When you see that kind of talk, I'm thinking of like Dennis. Was it Dennis Prager? No, maybe it wasn't Dennis Prager. Who was it?
So. Who mentioned a coming civil war?
Right, yeah.
Well, I've seen various.
It was in the National Review. I think it was Prager. I don't remember. Anyway, it was in the National Review pretty recently, and it comes from people who are very pro-Trump, who are doing their best to create rationalizations and justifications in their head for why they're compromising their principles left and right in service to this president. And one of the ways in which they do that, transparently, is to say that this is an existential moment we're living through. It's the Flight 93 election forever and ever, because in the event that they turn their backs on Donald Trump or whatever the moment demands of them, is the moment that we lose the country. And then they do use civil war rhetoric to to justify this position in their heads, and that is irresponsible. But it is not calling for militant actions
right.
or organizing militant actions, and we're seeing organized militant actions.
Right, on the left. Yeah, no, mostly the Civil War stuff, just to clarify, that I hear and that I read that comes out of the right is more along the lines of, I can't imagine that we're heading in any other direction
right.
but an eventual civil war. It's not, you know, okay, get your guns, meet me here. It's, you know, if things keep up at this rate, if we're splitting apart so dramatically and obviously and quickly, then we're headed for civil war. That's the kind of analysis.
And I bet that stuff is out there, but I haven't seen it in anything that's the equivalent of, you know, storied 100-year-old publications like The Nation or The New Republic or Mother Jones. I mean, these are pretty mainstream liberal organizations. And the notion, by the way, that these are only being read by conservatives and not liberals. I mean, you don't see this mainstream reporters are shocked positively by the notion that these people are who they are. Today I saw an image of Yvette Falarca in court responding to the charges that she's been charged with for her role in Sacramento. And I see these reporters going, well, look at her. She's, you know, she was an elementary school teacher. She's 5'9". She's got glasses and bangs. She's, you know, a harmless little thing. And like, you had no idea. You never even bothered to research this thing as though it's a conservative fixation. And then you're stunned when Berkeley's set alight. And by the way, I think, Abe, you're right when it comes to Nancy Pelosi, because in particular her preemptive denunciation of this group, not really preemptive, but more preemptive than because it's going to get worse before it gets better, sort of stands in contrast to how she wrapped her arms around the Occupy movement. Remember, it's like it's going to be effective, it's, you know, it's young, it's vivid, or whatever she said. And then it turned out to be, you know, a movement that was sort of these slovenly, you know, an archipelago of refugee camps full of rapists.
That's right. That's right.
And violent people. So the left is sort of coming to terms with the fact that they have this violent element among their ranks. And I think the more establishmentarian political wing of this movement is trying to be responsible. And the activist wing, the militant wing, just doesn't want to hear it. I mean, it sort of seems like they see it as a display of treachery almost, like a lack of fealty to the cause.
Yeah, it's the mirror image of rhinos.
Mm. Precisely, like you have to be really zealous. And to acknowledge existing political realities is a display of a lack of zealotry for the cause. Which brings us to my last thought. We're losing things, right? This is the thought is that we're losing the moment, we're losing the country, we're losing the presidency. Don't you wish you could find these things again? Maybe you need like a device to find your country, your principles, your moment again. Well, there's one way to do that. You know, sometimes we have these rituals. We have rituals of looking for things, and you know, just like we're looking for our moment, our place in the country, sometimes you're looking for your keys or your wallet. And what do? The first thing you check are places that you normally lose these things, like the couch or your kitchen or your pockets, weird places like the bathroom, the fridge, your laundry hamper, and then you start getting creative. You say, I'm going to look in the peanut jar for my keys. Your keys aren't in the peanut jar. Look, there's an easy way to get rid of this problem. 8 years ago, Tracker changed everything when they released their first tracking device. And now they've done it again with the all-new Tracker Pixel. With Tracker Pixel, you'll never have to worry about losing things again. Tracker Pixel is the lightest Bluetooth tracking device on the market. Place Tracker Pixel on whatever you tend to lose, your keys, your wallet, even your cat. It's small enough to fit anywhere. When you misplace an item that has the Tracker Pixel attached, use your smartphone and a 90 decibel alert, which is loud, will help you find it in seconds. It even has a powerful LED light, so you can find it in the dark. Lose your phone, just press a button on your Tracker Pixel, and the phone rings, even if it's on silent. You can even locate your item if it's miles away, because every Tracker user is part of the largest crowd locate network in the world. It's like Waze, the app for navigating through traffic, but for finding your things. And Tracker's 30-day money-back guarantee means you will truly have nothing to lose. Go to the Tracker website at thetracker.com. Enter promo code commentary to get 20% off any order. That's thetracker.com. Use promo code commentary for 20% off. Thetracker.com, promo code commentary. So I had something else that I kind of wanted to bounce off you, Abe, and I guess it's sort of theoretical. Why don't you first tell us where we are with the North Korea threat? When we last left, it was a threat, but we hadn't had a serious escalation that we had on Monday afternoon.
Right. Well, they've been ramping up these missile tests since Trump has become president. The latest serious one was, I already forget what day this was.
It was Monday.
It was Monday, where they flew a
intermediate range ballistic missile.
Yeah, over a Japanese island, and
it's bad.
Yes,
that's the first time that they've done that since 2009. The third time that they've violated Japanese airspace with a missile. It was 1998, 2009, and now, and each time was met with a very serious response. And one of the responses we're starting to see, which I think is kind of disturbing and what I want to explore, is the notion that the only real way to resolve this thing is to nuclearize Japan. Diplomacy is off the table, essentially. The president said as much the other day, Tuesday, I think it was. And the Defense Department says, well, diplomacy is never off the table. But the president's saying, we're not talking anymore. And frankly, that jibes with what we hear from our allies, that we're not interested in doing anything that's not a hard economic power or hard military power solution to this issue. But the hard military solution to this issue is catastrophic. Nobody even wants to contemplate it. So the only other option would be to surrender to the necessity of nuclearizing Japan, which likely means the nuclearization of South Korea, because South Korea is deeply suspicious of Japan, it is deeply suspicious of China, and deeply suspicious of North Korea. And we would essentially be saying to our allies at that stage that the American nuclear umbrella isn't worth the money that's, you know, written on the check. So you're going to fend for yourself. And both those nations have the capacity to develop a pretty substantial nuclear deterrent within a couple of months.
Right. And it would also essentially be saying we're going to opt for proliferation
right.
as an out. That's our new policy. Everyone, I mean, this is everyone arm up because we're not going to keep order.
That's what Donald Trump said as
That's
much in
right.
the campaign a couple of times, that everybody needs to develop nuclear weapons. So the thinking goes is that Japan gets nukes, scares the heck out of Beijing, because now they have an adversary in Northeast Asia that has achieved nuclear parity, and they get off the sidelines and engineer some sort of a way to, you know, off-ramp this North Korea crisis, whatever that may be. I don't even know if anybody's thought that far, but some sort of a peaceful resolution to the Kim regime and the various frustrations that it's responsible for over the course of, you know, however many decades now. So I had this thought, which is kind of some deep IR theory, but it's not too deep. I'll get into it. So we have this sort of strikes me as what's a multipolar dynamic. And what I mean by that is that there are three stages of international relations structures. The first is unipolar, which is the structure in which we are living now. We are blessed beyond belief to live in a period of unipolarity in which the United States is a hegemon and there is no other power that comes even remotely close in terms of hard power. There have been a couple of other unipolarities in history, and they all are associated with pieces, great pieces that are maintained by that hegemon, the Pax Romana, the Pax Britannica. We're in the middle of one right now.
Yeah. No piece so great as ours.
No, ours is the best piece.
Yeah.
The biggest piece.
Yes.
Huge. The second condition is bipolarity. And now you can think of the Cold War, where you have two dynamics, two poles that are competing with each other, seeking either advantage or the maintenance of the balance of power. These are stable periods, but they're not peaceful. Again, look at the Cold War. That was an extremely bloody period. It was just one in which the two superpowers never went to war, largely as a result of nuclear weapons, but it was a pretty bloody period for everybody else who wasn't in one of those superpowers. And the third dynamic is multipolarity. So there are many poles. And for that, you can look to pre-World War I Europe, pre-World War II Europe, where you have parity among a variety of nations. Alliances are fluid. They shift. They develop. They dissolve, all in order to keep one another off balance. It's very difficult to game out how a variable will play in that system because there are so many variables at work at once that it's easy to miscalculate. And there's a reason why they usually devolve into war, because those miscalculations happen frequently, and it only takes one to spiral out of control. So we're entering into a period where, let's say, nuclear weapons sort of neutralize the hard power dynamic. Once you achieve nuclear capability, you can deliver a bomb, you're a member of the club. So we have nuclear multipolarity in the event that Japan ascends to the nuclear club, because we have a ton of nuclear powers in Asia and a bunch of alliances that are shifting all over the place. So we have the United States and Japan, which are allies. South Korea has a problem with Japan, and it's probably going to nuclearize. North Korea and China are allied, but it's a sort of a frustrating alliance. So you would see some sort of a bipolar dynamic there, but you also have to take into account India and Pakistan, which are nuclear powers, and they're very much players in this game. The United States has major non-NATO allied status with Pakistan, but it's a very tense relationship, and we're already cozying up to India. China has a very big problem with India, which could compel Pakistan to fall into India's sphere. That could all, or Pakistan to fall into China's sphere, which could allow North Korea the opportunity to escape its isolation. And all of these alliances are working and shifting all at once, and everybody's trying to play off each other. And you can see how you introduce a couple of different variables into that dynamic, and you lose the plot, and the game gets away from you. That's what I'm thinking is the worst case scenario in the event that we have a nuclear Japan. Everybody thinks that we are going to see the kind of parity and stability that we saw in the Cold War. And I'm not entirely sure that that dynamic is going to hold.
This perfectly describes the danger in all the thinking, largely among liberal and left-wing theorists, but it also exists on the right. It's been happening for years and years, for decades, in fact, about American decline and how our influence, our ability to influence other countries and to keep peace and to have other countries do our bidding, and to have an American-led liberal world order is coming to an end. Now, it's one thing to say that and dread it and work against it. There's always been an element in a lot of these decline theorists where there's a sort of glee about it, like where the world will now be sort of set right because we won't be pushing around these powers anymore, and when we're the problem. That only works, and it in fact wouldn't work even if this were true, but that could conceivably only work if there were, let's say, the complete eradication of nuclear weapons as opposed to their buildup. Right. The combination of the two, if you're going to set us on a path, a hopeful path of multipolarity, without doing something about new countries acquiring nuclear technology and delivery systems, that is a surefire recipe for biblical disaster.
And we saw something like a multipolar dynamic on a regional scale arise during the Obama administration and its very failed effort to extricate the United States from the Middle East. The effort on the part of the Obama administration, albeit unspoken, was to build up Iran, create a powerful Iran that could represent a balance against a powerful set of Sunni kingdoms and regimes, headquartered sort of loosely around Riyadh and sort of loosely around Cairo. And that Iran was going to build itself up in Iraq. It was going to fill up the vacuum in Iraq, at least sort of. And it was going to stabilize the Levant. And what we saw instead was the Saudi kingdoms and the Saudi regimes sort of react in terror about that prospect and work in their way to fill up those vacuums in their own way. And the alliance structures started getting all fluid, like we saw again. And we've seen a remarkable thaw in relations between the Sunni powers in the region and Jerusalem. Israel has become something with which the Sunni powers in the region can live with, even without a resolution to the Palestinian problem. In fact, the Palestinian problem is arguably getting worse, and nobody seems to mind, at least not in the Sunni capitals, because they have a better, bigger problem to deal with. But these dynamics are sort of immutable, and when the United States fails to live up to its obligations, the obligations of a hyperpower, then everybody else steps up.
Now, you know, I want to say there is one thing that can be done regarding North Korea. If you're the president, and the North Korean regime is amplifying its threats and ratcheting up its missile tests and doing what it does, you know, sort of every decade or so, the surefire way to get everyone to sort of sleep easy once again temporarily is to give them things. This is what we've done again and again. We've been doing it for decades. It's in part the thinking behind their ramping up technology and threatening us. It's to strengthen their negotiating hand. I would not be surprised if we do it yet again. Despite the talks of diplomacy being dead and whatnot. Sure. It is such a temptation to this is if there's a can that everyone wants to kick down the road, yeah. It's this can. And there's a path to doing it. The huge risk, and the risk builds and builds and builds every time we kick the can, is that their provocations, the North Korean provocations, have to become larger and larger each time. You cannot threaten us with the same thing you threatened us last time, if what you want is more.
I kind of would be surprised if that dynamic restores itself. We do have sort of a conciliatory regime in Seoul, more than it used to be. It's not exactly a sunshine policy, but it's still consolation. But there's not any appetite for that in Japan. Japan is taking a really hard line with North Korea this time around. They are pretty adamantly against talks from everything we've seen in public. What they want to see is renewed economic pressure, and they're lobbying very hard for that. The Trump administration is not exactly friendly toward the idea of conciliation with North Korea, at least to the extent that they've been public about it. And we're not dealing with Kim Jong-il anymore. I mean, we haven't had that. We don't know how to work with the UN regime, as it were, because, you know, you could always ply Kim Jong-il with a creative Kvassier, and this guy seems a little more dogmatic, I guess, a little more strict. I'm not sure. I don't really see him being all that interested in taking a payoff. We haven't seen anything that's signaling that they'll take a payoff.
I don't think we know. I mean, that regime is such a mystery.
Right.
Its structure is such a secret. You know, I mean,
well, also,
I don't know.
Even if there was an option, is it one that we can even accept at this stage? The reality is that if we've gotten to the point where they have a reliable, deliverable nuclear capability, you know, intercontinental ballistic missiles, a miniaturized bomb, and a vehicle that can survive reentry into the Earth's atmosphere, then we've accepted the fact that they can drop a missile on 30,000 American troops in the course of 30 seconds, and there's nothing we can do about it. Are we prepared to accept that? I mean, we shouldn't be.
Right, of course. Right.
But
it's not in a vacuum. You know, not accepting it entails a whole other potential horror show.
Right.
You know, I mean, all
that would definitely precipitate mass nuclearization around the world if we were to say, you know, we're just going to let this one slide.
That's right.
Because there's nothing we can do about that. Then that would absolutely facilitate, you know, nuclearization, I guess, from Seoul and Tokyo and probably elsewhere.
Right, right. I mean, that's part of the problem with thinking that we can contain them also, is that if this doesn't rise to the level of a threat that we simply cannot let stand, then nothing does, you know.
Sure.
An unpredictable, cruel regime that exists to be cruel and defy international norms.
And of course, North Korean provocations are Iranian provocations. The two are inexorably linked. They have commercial and military relations, and they fund each other's illicit weapons programs. Iran is pretty much fait accompli in nuclear power. We are dancing around that notion, but the Iran deal essentially cemented its ability to break out whenever it really wants to. And we introducing that into the Asian multipolar dynamic extends the multipolar dynamic into the Middle East, where you also have aspiring nuclear powers, people like Saudi Arabia, who could very easily start a program or buy an off-the-shelf weapon from Pakistan, which we know they've been interested in doing in the past, which would precipitate nuclearization all across the region. And we're talking about a lot of intersecting alliances that are just, it's just too easy to trip one of those wires. And that's the fear. And it's one I don't think very many people have really contemplated, because it's very complicated. You know, I mean, I'm not talking about something that's easy to comprehend, frankly. There's so many variables that you just can't play them out. And B, because it's really scary. Yeah, so anyway, we're going to, I suppose
You know what? We succeeded. I think we've even without John here, we've achieved our.
This isn't morosity. That's not morosity. That's terror.
Okay.
I'm not morose.
It's crushing.
It is crushing. You should be overwhelmed with fear, but not morosity. It's not as though there's no options here. We are in control of our own fates and our own destinies. These are not, this is not predestination. We're not Calvinists here. We can get out of this if we all work together. So this is my fondest hope. I ended on an optimistic note. With that, I think we're going to say goodbye for the end of the week's commentary podcast. John will be back with us on Monday. I know you're dying for it. He will be here, I promise you. And that will be the beginning of the fall season, where we get to talk about fun things like the debt ceiling and the budget and continuing resolutions and the wall. Yeah. Thank you for listening. This has been the Commentary Magazine podcast. Keep the candle burning.